You're probably looking for some champagne at this time of year, and I'll tell you, an absolutely delicious wine that you might overlook otherwise is the 2006 Brut Natur from Louis Roederer. I was personally knocked out by the Brut Natur myself, and it's one of those wines that's totally of a piece in the way it tastes. It's harmonious, delicious, very drinkable. It's really excellent, and it has a sense of Cumiere that I would be hard-pressed to really put in another bottle of wine. The more I've learned about this particular bottling, the more impressed I've become, because it was planned out from the grape level, which is kind of something that sounds like everyone does it, but I think it's pretty unusual to this degree. The idea was there are these kinds of grapes from this parcel, this kind of parcel in this particular place, and picking them together and co-fermenting them, you could come up with this kind of result, maybe, because this was something that they did as sort of an experiment, a trial to see what would happen if they really put themselves out on the ledge like this. And honestly, what happened is they turned out with a really delicious wine. It's excellent. I recommend that you check it out, and the team at Crush Wine and Spirits is making that easier with a discount for the 2006 Louis Roederer Brut Natur available to listeners of the podcast. The price for a bottle of the Roederer Brut Natur is usually $84.95. But it comes down to $81.95 for you. You can call Crush at 212-980-9463 and use the offer code IDTTFORME, or use that same promo code online at crushwineco.com. The Louis Roederer Brut Natur is particularly delicious, and it's a particularly astounding bottle of wine if you're into learning about the terroirs of Champagne. Call Crush Wine and Spirits to get some for yourself. I'll drink to that, where we get behind the scenes of the beverage business. I'm Levy Dalton.
I'm Erin Scala.
And here's our show today.
Are you guys ready to get warmed up? Because I am.
Most wine bottles, especially in the U.S., contain the same amount of wine, 750 milliliters or 3/4 of a liter. Of course, we'll have some alternate formats. We've got large formats and splits. But having fairly universal wine increments in the market is something that came to be in the 20th century. Where did the 750 milliliter bottle come from, and how has it impacted how we think about wine? The buying and selling of wine from producers to consumers in glass bottles really became commonplace in the early 1900s. The norm before that was to sell wine from wineries in barrels, which would be tapped in the home. At home, glass vessels would be used to transfer the wine from the barrel to the tabletop, similar to a decanter. A size approximate to 750 milliliters was an easily producible size by a glass blower without having to get too technical in the glass blowing process. It was also a size that was easy for most people to carry around. The World Wars also had an impact on determining how much wine should be in a daily portion. War rations were practical. Ration amounts would find themselves somewhere on a spectrum, with the minimum required on one end and the maximum that could be transported in battle on the other end. In World War I, for instance, French soldiers had 1-liter canteens. But those fighting in North Africa had 2-liter canteens because the access to the water supply was more difficult. When moving rations in Europe became harder during World War I, everyone got 2-liter canteens. In practice, most French soldiers carried 2 canteens, one for water mixed with wine, and the other for coffee, sometimes mixed with spirit. The alcohol acted as a preservative and also as liquid courage in horrifying battle situations. American World War I canteens held 1 quart, a little less than 1 liter, and some Americans preferred to carry the 2-liter French canteens so they could transport more liquid in one container. A wine ration was one way to move water without spoiling it during the wars. During World War I, French wine rations changed from 1 liter to 0.5 liter and evened out at around 0.75 liter, which is 750 milliliters. So the idea of a daily portion of wine for a person had a subconscious fixing at somewhere between 500 milliliters and 1 liter by the end of World War I. Our idea of this daily quantity in part came out of the practicalities of getting nourishment to soldiers, but the fixing of the measure at 750 milliliters in the U.S. came much later out of the practicalities of a different nature. In the 1970s, the U.S. almost joined the metric system, and the Alcohol and Tobacco Tax and Trade Bureau were up at the front. They took the first steps and converted their regulations from gallons, quarts, and pints to the metric system. They chose units of measure that corresponded closely with the previous standards, one of which was the fifth, standing for a fifth of a gallon. 750 milliliters was very close to a fifth, and the Bureau decided that this regulation would make the transition to the metric system easier on the American people. This fixing of 750 milliliters happened fairly recently, in 1980. In the U.S., having a universal incremental format for wine has greatly impacted the wine marketplace. Pricing wines in these increments have done one vastly incredible thing. It has created a constant on which we may more easily measure the market value of the liquid inside. Imagine someone buying and selling wine when all of the bottle sizes are different. To determine the value of, say, a glass pour, you'd first have to determine how many milliliters were in the bottle, how much each milliliter was worth, and how many milliliters were in your glass pour, and then you could add your markup in order to properly price the wine. In a very general sense, we've become accustomed to placing a value for this amount in our minds. This has allowed us to judge wines against one another by comparing their marketplace values. Imagine back in the barrel days, knowing that barrel A is a 250-liter barrel and costs $400, and barrel B is 275 liters and costs $550, and barrel C is a 600-liter barrel and it costs $760. It means that to compare the values of the liquid inside, you'd have to do some math. But these same three wines in 750-milliliter bottles can be compared much more quickly. Barrel A is $1.2 per 750 mL, barrel B is $1.5 per 750 mL, and barrel C is 95 cents per 750 mL. You can clearly tell which bottles are worth more in the marketplace when you're dealing with the same increment of measure. And when you place this in the context of how the wines taste, you can very quickly tell which wines are bargains and which wines are overpriced because you have a clear price baseline between different products from different places. Fixing a general size made it easier for consumers and sellers of wine to value and compare the prices of liquid. But the fixing of the sizes might never have come about without, you guessed it, taxes. The Alcohol and Tobacco Tax and Trade Bureau has an obligation to collect taxes on alcohol, and fixed liquid values make it much easier to determine the tax on the bottles. So in short, why do we have the 750-milliliter wine bottle standard in the U.S.? Taxes. It always comes back to taxes.
I'm Michelle Basilia, wine director of Blue Hill, New York City.
Lee Campbell from Diner in Brooklyn.
This is Sharon Severins from Amonti Vino in Montclair, New Jersey.
Patrick Capiello, Rebel and Pearl and Ash.
Ian Doran from the Wine Library.
Jeremy Noy, Morel Fine Wine Retail and Wine Bar at Rockefeller Center.
These tri-state buyers all know that 750 is a one-stop resource for the beverage alcohol trade. Search across distributor portfolios, see trade tastings, and easily connect with your sales rep. It's free and easy to sign up. Vinitaly is the largest wine and spirits fair in the entire world, and it's coming up in April in Verona, Italy. I was just in Verona myself, and I totally loved it. But have you ever had the chance to go yourself? If you have never been to Vinitaly, and you are a professional wine buyer for an importer, retailer, or restaurant focused on Italian wine, I may have a ticket for you to be there. There will be a buyer's trip to the Vinitaly Fair on April 10th through the 13th of 2016, and it will be an excellent chance to attend one of the most extensive wine tasting opportunities on earth. There will be regional-focused tastings. There will be extensive tastings of top producers, like the Opera Wine Tasting on the 9th of April, featuring 100 great wineries. And there will be opportunities to meet face-to-face with a number of growers at your own pace. Very awesomely, there is a travel stipend available to attend. If you are a wholesale buyer, all you have to do to get started is to send an email to media@vinitalytour.com. That's media@vinitalytour.com with a paragraph describing your work as a buyer and your interest in Italian wine. There will also be other Vinitaly organized events coming up in the States, and those will be good opportunities for those interested to learn more about the buyer's program that will be headed to Verona in April. If you want to know more, you should seek those events out. Vinitaly's American tour will touch down in San Francisco on the 17th through the 19th of January. It'll be in New York City on the 9th of February and in Miami on the 10th of February. Write to media@vinitalytour.com for further details. The Vinitaly Fair is a tremendous opportunity to experience what Italy has to offer. I personally can't recommend it enough. If you're a wholesale buyer, this is a great chance to be in Verona tasting for yourself with producers you care about. I highly recommend that you do so. Peter Leem's ChampagneGuide.net was a key resource for me when I was preparing for this interview. If you're interested in champagne, I highly recommend that you check it out. It is the best resource I know about champagne in English today. Again, ChampagneGuide.net from Peter Leem. Jean-Baptiste Lacayon of Champagne Louis Roederer on the show. Hello, sir. How are you?
Very good, Levy. Very happy to be with you.
Very nice to see you. So you were born somewhat near the Champagne area.
Yeah, close to Champagne, in Lorraine, which is not far. You know, it's in between Strasbourg, Alsace, and Champagne, because my mother's family were from there. So she wanted to give birth on her homeland. So I was born there, but I never lived there. In fact, I lived in Champagne right away because my parents were living in Champagne.
What were your parents like?
My parents were really, really open people, loving, and they're still, because they're still alive. They love nature, they love going in the forest and doing any kind of country promenade or country walks and things like that. And I think it's something is important because by learning that as soon as you're from your birth or from when you're young, you really are very sensitive. You know, I think it's kind of more sensitivity to nature, observation, more humility at the end because you have an aesthetical vision of things. And even the smell of autumn in the forest, the smell of the wheat when it's ripe, you know, or of corn or grapes, it brings something, you know, it brings your memory in, at least. And this is all about memory, what we are doing.
What was the career of your father?
My father was, I have two generations before me of beer maker. So I always say that I have bubbles in my blood, but it's not champagne, it's beer. And so the beer family company was sold to Stella Artois, you know, the big Belgium company. And my father started to do something else, and he worked as a PR person for medicine, you know, for...
like a pharmaceutical?
Yeah, pharmacy, and a big German company. And he's done that all his life. Yeah.
That must have been a big change.
Yeah, it's a big change from beer to medicine. But in the end, maybe beer is medicine.
What were your interests as a kid? I mean, what were you?
I was really a person of the land. You know, we had a country house with my parents, and I was always all the weekends. I was helping the farmers next door. You know, I was very good friend with them, so I was doing everything in the farm. So that was my weekend love. So, and I really love that. I think it comes to nature and what you like, what you smell, what you see, and working with cows and different animals as well. Just being a part of a wall that is bigger than you. Yeah? That's the story of life.
And when did you decide wine was going to be a part of that story?
That's back in 1981. In fact, it was, I remember very well. It's a very French story, in fact, because I was 14 years old, and we went to visit a very famous French writer called Henri Vincenot from Burgundy. He died now, but he wrote a few beautiful books on Burgundy tradition, Burgundy people, Burgundy soul, and... one of them is La Bille Baude, but there is a most beautiful one, which is called Le Pape des Escargots, published back in 73, 74. And we went to visit as a school study. We were studying this book, and we went with all the class.
It was about snails, Pope of Snails.
Yeah, Pope of Snails, yeah. And we went to see, to visit him, to talk about his books. And it's in Burgundy. It was in Burgundy. And the man was really, really full of story about where what was Burgundy, what was, you know, it's a very Burgundian, I think most, the most famous Burgundian writer. And among, in this visit, we went to Dujac, and Jack says, prepare the tasting. So it's very French because we were 14 and we drank a lot of wine. So I loved it, not to be drunk, but I loved the wines. And then I think it's kind of my epiphany, you know, at this day, I came back and I say, I will make wine because the story of the people, the story of the place, the story of the terroir, in fact, the wine itself, it's something, it speaks to me. It speaks to me. And so from 14 onwards, I say, I will make wine one day. I didn't say I will make champagne or I will make Burgundy or make Bordeaux or anything like that, but I will live that wine life. You know, that will be my wine life.
And by 89, you were working for Roeder.
Yes, yes. So I did my study. I did my PhD or, you know, all the stories, the University of Montpellier. You know, I
was, you went to Montpellier.
Yeah.
That's unusual, right?
Yeah, yeah. But that's the best school in university in France where you first study viticulture and then you do winemaking. And I think this is the right way to do it. Too many people go and learn winemaking. But learning winemaking is like eating a plate without sugar or without salt, you know. I think you really need to understand what is in the grapes themselves, what makes the grapes so unique. So I studied in Montpellier, which is a place where you could do that. And I graduated with honors of this. And then straight away I went to Roeder in 89, and I flew to California because that was the time of the second harvest for Roeder in California, in Anderson Valley. So the Michel Salg was the winemaker at the time in California, and he needed some help to go from a few bottles to a few hundred thousand bottles. So I was the second in charge with him in Anderson Valley. And I spent a year, I should have spent 3 or 4 years. That was a plan. But I spent, in the end, I spent just 1 year because at the same time, Roeder started a joint venture in Tasmania, so in Australia. The game being to produce the first sparkling wine of Tasmania. We needed someone on the spot. So Jean-Claude Rousseau, the owner of Roeder, said, would you go to Tasmania with your family for a while? And I've been there for 3.5 years. You know, I worked there and I launched the first Tasmanian sparkling wine called Jens. Now it's not anymore in the Roeder family, but I worked 4 years there.
What was that experience like?
Great, super experience. I think I was, when I touched base in Tasmania, I had to go to see the French consul in Melbourne, you know, to identify myself. And there was a very nice old man, and he told me, listen, you will be the only French in Tasmania. So I'm on the other side of the Bass Strait, you know, the sea. But so I'm your contact, but you will be alone. So I was alone on the other side. And so the only French in Tasmania. That was a bit strange. That was the end of the world, you know, for us at the time. Today, I think there is many, many more people, French winemakers, I think it has developed, grown, and things like that. So it was kind of a pioneer time. And
did they treat you nice? I mean, yeah, what were the working habits like?
I think the most important, the most interesting thing was the number of grapes I was growing. I was doing Sauvignon Blanc, Merlot, Riesling, Cabernet Sauvignon, Pinot Noir, Chardonnay, Traminer, all kind of, every single grape on earth was growing in the estate. So for a young winemaker wanting to learn his job, and I had two or three cellar hands, but not a big group. So I had to do everything myself with a team. So very hands-on work and all kind of wines. The harvest was lasting 4 months from the first Pinot for sparkling wine to the cab that we were picking 4 months after. So 4 months of harvest. That was kind of, I don't know if I would be able to do it now for 30 years later, but that was great experience.
A good comparative for you.
Yeah, yeah. And doing every single job every in the vineyards, pruning, tying, grafting, driving tractors, hunting wallabies, shooting wallabies at night because they were eating the grapes, and it was a load.
Were you a good shot? Or?
Yeah, I was not good. I was not good, but it was a load. It was not forbidden because we had some permit to do it, and making wines, rolling the barrels, racking, pumping, bottling. All this, I've done it, and I think it's really built me I know every single job. So, and I think it really helps me when I came back to Champagne after, where the cellar workers, you know, an old Champagne company, you know, where seeing a young winemaker, you know, it can be a challenge. But all my team saw immediately that I knew how to do every single work in the cellar. So I think it gives you respect. It gives you respect. And it's not an enologist who doesn't know how to do it. It was someone who knew the practical of winemaking. And I think it gave me immediately some respect from the team. And my team, I think it's more than respect. In fact, I think they followed me. They followed me straight away.
Which is probably a large team, right?
Oh, yeah. When you have the large team, is complicated. I have 50 vignerons, 50 cellar people. So I have 100% of permanent. At harvest time, I have 600 pickers. During the season, I have 150 to 200 persons. So that's a lot of people. I believe very much in people. And I think if you want to go to the next step in quality in winemaking, you need to empower people. So you need to give them responsibility. You need to... Of course, you have a vision of what should be done in this vineyard, or in the cellar, or in the wine, but you also need to empower them so that they are part of the story. They make it. If you succeed in that, I really think that you find a window of never-ending possibility of creation, because every single worker has creativity in his hands, and that makes a big difference. So I think that's a people story. Wine is a man's story. It's, of course, a terroir story, the grapes, the place, the history, the culture, the people. All of that is important. But man is the key to quality and to innovation, creation. And it's a never-ending process.
What was your mandate when you got back to France? What did your boss tell you?
So when I got back to France, it was 94. That was a time where we had bought our first Bordeaux properties in Saint-Estèphe, Château Au Beau Séjour. And in 95, we bought Château de Pèze. Two small estates in Saint-Estèphe, and we didn't have the structure to hire a manager. So I was managing that from Champagne, spending at a minimum of 1 week a month in Saint-Estèphe to lead the team. In Bordeaux. So as always, when you buy an estate, you have to reconsider everything. You have to study all the soils. You have to understand the place. You have to understand the wine. You have to visit everybody around because to see how they do, what they taste like, test many, 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 many wines, retest many, many, many wines to see where you stand and where you have to work. And so it took me quite a lot of time, and I did that from 94 to 97, 98. And in 97, I hired a winemaker from Carbonieux. He came from Carbonieux to be the man on the spot because I had too much work in Champagne. So I hired a very good winemaker from Carbonieux, and we worked together during 15 years.
But that's an interesting run of vintages that you had by yourself there, 95, 96, 97. Those are all pretty different.
Yeah.
In Bordeaux,
yes. It's true, 95, very unusual vintage with so small berries, you know, so dark skin, very concentrated, very austere tannins. So a monster 95. And then 96, I didn't see really 96 as it is, because in 95, that's the time I decided to stop using herbicides, and I replowed tilling all the vineyards, and it was not tilled for 15 years, so the roots were a little bit on the top of the soil, and I think I really worked all the soil, tilled all the soils in 96, and I think the vines at harvest were a little bit depressed. I think when you reintroduce tilling, you get so many roots with your machine that the vines really stress a little bit. And I think I missed this vintage in Saint-Estèphe. It should have done better. But and 97, it's another story, 97.
What made you do that decision? I mean, what led you to that choice?
I think it was kind of intuition or
but not the normal in Bordeaux, certainly not even today, let alone at that time.
At that time, the Grand Cru, yes, were all tilled, but the Cru Bourgeois were not, you know, it was a question of cost. What made me do that? I think it's a question of ambition. Ambition of when we buy an estate with Rodreur, we first buy a great terroir, and then we want to introduce our knowledge in the terroir to really lift the quality up. And my ambition was to, a long-term ambition, was to lift quickly the quality up. And unfortunately, when you have a long-term ambition, the short-term can be not that good a decision, but you miss one vintage. And after 97, you have the first return from your work, and 98 and 99 and 2000. So I think it's, you have to know in our job, to know how to forget the short term, especially in my job today. Because, you know, as you know, for Cristal, for example, the vines which make Cristal, they are minimum of 25 years old, average 40 years old, which means that I have been with the house for 27 years. Rodreur, that means that I'm just starting to work with the fruit I planted 25 years ago or 27 years ago. So everything I'm planting today is for my successor. I won't make the wine. And most of the wine I make today, it's because of my predecessor or because thanks to my predecessor. Like that, if it's not good, I can say it's not my fault. And if it's great, I say, you see, I'm very good at it.
But at the same time, I mean, I think what you're saying also implies that you get a fair amount of trust from your current boss, right? I mean,
yeah, it's really a chance I got. I think a mutual respect. It shows me. He came to the university and said to my professor at Montpellier, he said, "I want your best student. Give me your best student, your best." And
that guy wasn't available, and so then they. No, I'm kidding around. I'm joking.
Exactly. Yeah, the guy was sick, you know. my professor Denis Boubals, a monster in the wine world, you know, a great man, fantastic man, said, "Oh, you're lucky, Jean-Claude, because my best student is from Champagne, but you have a double luck because not only is the best in winemaking, but he's also the best in viticulture because I graduated first on the two topics." So he said, "You're lucky, he's from Champagne." And so I think right away with Jean-Claude, he chose me, and Frédéric, his son, continued that. I think it's a question of really, we share the same values, we have the same vision, and it's more than that. They let me show the way. You know, when I reintroduced biodynamics or even tilling at Château de Pez, they followed me. You know, they said, "Go for it." When I reintroduced biodynamic in Champagne in 2000, Jean-Claude said, I told Jean-Claude, "I want to do that. What do you think?" And Jean-Claude said, he had a long thinking, and he said, "Listen, you are very courageous. I would not have this courage or this strength to do it, but do it." So for him, it was a something very, very good. He believed in the idea, but what an investment, you know, a personal investment and a team investment. So it was, he knew that the mountain will be hard to climb, but he really let me go. And today, I think he shares my views, and his son shares completely my view as well. I'm not saying that I have all the views, because they have son and father, great views as well. So it's a really a win-win job. And I always say, we always think, and Frédéric would be here, he would say the same, we think the great wines of the world have always been made by two persons.
And why do you think that is?
The owner and the technicians, or the enologist, or the viticulturist, you call it.
So you're saying I should have two mics?
Exactly. And you have one.
Well, I need three, apparently. Yeah.
No, I think it's important. This is this double. We call that in the family the eagle with a double head, you know. It's a double-headed eagle. If you want to see 360 degrees, you need this vision. And so that's the way the family think. That's the way I think. So it's a win-win.
Jean-Claude had been associated with a lot of revitalization and growth with that company, right? As a brand. He really turbocharged it.
Yes, completely.
And then at the end, he hires you. Like kind of towards the end of his run, he knows he's going to hand it off and he hires you, right?
Yeah, it's not at the end. It's at the middle. I was his right-hand man since 89 because I was a man who was, you're exactly right. I think he started California. He started, he had Australia. He had Portugal. He had Bordeaux. And I was his trust man. You know, I was a man that his right-hand man, traveling the world for him, you know, for his vision. So I think he had to trust me, and I had to be completely committed to the vision. And so that worked very well. So we were 10 years together. He tested me, I guess, or he saw my resilience and my loyalty. I think you need to work with a family, a wine family like that, a seven-generation wine family. You need resilience. Humility, not to be the ego. My ego cannot be bigger than Jean-Claude or Frédéric. My ego has to be smaller. And you have to be committed and loyal. If you have those four values, you're the man. And I think it's really who I am. I think I'm this kind of humility, this kind of resilience, and this search for perfection is who I am. So that's fine. And after 10 years, he saw that I was the right man. So when I think it's maybe why it was so easy for him to give the comments to his son, because he knew that I would continue, I will be with him.
And when did you realize that about yourself? I mean, I understand what you're saying and I agree with you, but it's not everyone who can articulate that about themselves. Mm-hmm. So when did you realize that you had those qualities? I mean, did you know from the beginning or did it take a while? Were there moments that you said, okay, maybe I can do this?
You have a strong chance when you're in a family company. That's the difference, is that there is no challenge. Only the owner is legitimate. You cannot fight with the owner. He is the owner. It's his money. It's his story. You are just here to participate to the next level, or to bring the company to another level, but it's not your company. I think it's very important to have the owner and a technician. The owner is the money on the long-term view. The technician must be here to express his talent on the art. And so after, it's a choice. Huh? If you want to be the big shot or the big man, I could have been somewhere else. I had some proposition at the beginning to go somewhere else. But I think there's so much to do in this beautiful estate of Rodreur and the international experience as well. It's unique. There's no other chef de cave that can travel. I travel every month in Domaine Haute, in Portugal. I go twice a year in California. I can see, I do five vintage in a year, five vintages with the other estates. So I learn five times quicker.
Did you have that kind of relationship with your father that you had with the Rosar family?
Yeah, my father, I think I'm very lucky because my parents have been very trustful in me. You know, they always trusted me. And I think they let me, my parents did with me maybe what I didn't do with my children, which is they really had full faith in me.
if the children are listening, yes. Sorry about that.
But my children, you know, maybe I was a little bit more, with my children, a little bit more, not overlooking, but a little bit more loving with them. You know, I think it's, I'm maybe too much present with my children, you know. I think sometimes parents must let the children grow.
Get out of the nest, you know, a little bit.
It's the same with the wine. So yeah, my parents were like that, you know, they really trusted me and they let me do what I wanted. You know, when I was 14 or 16 doing crazy things, they were happy with that. You know?
The chef de cave duties come in 99. What's your first thought?
Fortunately or unfortunately, when I had managed all those estates in California, in Australia and in Bordeaux, and when Jean-Claude offered me the chef de cave position, maybe he didn't expect my reaction, but I told Jean-Claude, yes, I accept one condition. I want also the vineyard. Because the tradition in Champagne is that chef de cave is making the wine, the blends, is the man who speaks about the wine. But the viticulturist or the chef de culture is growing grapes in the vineyards, and they don't speak too much. You know, it's kind of a strange situation where one has finished his job at harvest and the other one starts his job after harvest. I never understood this stop. You know, this is like the 31st of December. I never understand. it's never ending. So everybody is, there is a big fiesta and people are happy. This is the end of the year, but the day after it's a new year, but it doesn't change, you know? So it's the same with the work in the vineyards. It never stops. It's a continuum. It's a continuum. So you could have two positions. First position is a teamwork. You give me the bowl and I transform it. That would be a way to do it. Or there is maybe a new way that I created, because that's the first time ever a chef de cave would be in charge of the vineyard in Champagne, which is I want the vineyards in my department because I want to really control every of my lieu-dit, every of my parcel, to craft the wine in the vineyards, not in the cellar. Do it in the vineyards. So I told Jean-Claude, give me the vineyards. And it didn't take long, I think 5 minutes, for him to say, okay, do it. That's a great idea. And so I took the vineyard at this time, and then the revolution in the vineyard started, you know, in Champagne. We had to reintroduce tilling immediately, like I did in Saint-Estèphe, with more slowly, maybe not as strongly as in Saint-Estèphe, because I had the 96 vintage in mind. You know, reintroduce tilling, started the biodynamic trials, organic, biodynamic, and things like that, and restarted massal selection, which has been stopped for 20 years. So jumped on the old parcels before clonal selection, pre-60 plantation, to the reservoir, to go to the collection, to pick individuals that would be interesting, Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. Do the same with broodstock. So I really relaunched everything in the vineyards to bring the vineyards to the next step of maybe expression. Let's call it that way. And I was lucky enough to hire a young enologist at the time, which I did the same that Jean-Claude did with me. You know, I went to university and I saw this guy. We had a long talk together. And now, and since 2001 or 2002, he's my right-hand man in the vineyards. Very natural, very loving the vineyards. And he carries all the vision in the vineyards every day. So one more time, a teamwork that is important.
So when you have a team that is as large as yours, what are the keys to doing those kind of changes in the vineyard? I mean, how do you approach that?
The keys is nothing is possible without people being empowered. So you need to spend enough time to explain. You need to spend enough time to visit estates. In Burgundy, I went to see Dominique Lafont. I went to see Anne-Claude Lefebvre. I went to see Jean-Michel Dice. I went to see Jean-Pierre Fleury in Courteron, you know, who had started the first estate of biodynamic estate in Champagne is Jean-Pierre Fleury. So we went to see those people, and we found, and thanks to Dominique Lafont, we found a fantastic man. His name is Pierre Masson, who is this kind of biodynamic person, which is a believer, but has a lot of, he simplifies things. It's not, because in biodynamics, sometimes it's too complicated, or you're lost, or there is one recipe and things like that. So I think it's not good to replace a recipe by another recipe. Never. So what I was looking for is more opening windows. Think outside the box, create some new windows, reconnect people to the land, reconnect. You know, today we are in the digital world. We talk about a lot about interconnection. But I think the best way to reconnect is to stop using chemicals, stop using technology sometimes, and you reconnect to the place. And so we were lucky to find those people. All my team saw that. And I think everybody realized at one point, more or less, because I'm not telling you that everybody is convinced, but everybody understood that it was worth doing it. It was worth trying to do it, and it was more interesting for them. It makes sense to their job by being involved at this point very, very, very closely. So we did that, and some are not yet completely convinced. The only way I can convince them when I do biodynamic is that, do you prefer to have antibiotics all around you, or do you prefer to have copper or sulfur for your own health? And the answer is always the same. I prefer copper and sulfur, but no antibiotics. So maybe they don't believe in it, but it's good for them. So if it's good for them, it must be good for the vine as well. So train the people, convince, and convince again. And don't stop, because even if everybody's laughing around, because we had to face this in Champagne 15 years ago, even not only biodynamic, when we started tilling, all the growers around saying, you're crazy, you're destroying all the progress we have done since all of that. And you need a good sense of resilience to face that. And me, but it's easy for me, but my team, you know, my team, because everybody was laughing 15 years ago. Now nobody laughs.
Well, the wines are quite good, I think.
Yeah, and everybody is doing the same, so that's fine. It shows that it was not wrong.
What are examples at Roeder where winemaking decisions are made in the vineyard, where the wine style is actually determined in the vineyard?
It starts in the process of selection of soil. I try to make subsoil wine, not soil wine, subsoil wine. So the first thing I did is a complete study of the soil, studying with a geologist from Bordeaux University, and doing holes to see where the bedrock was, what was the chalk content, the clay content, the sand content, the structure, the compaction, all of that. So I did full study on the vineyards, on the 410 parcels. It's a huge work. And then at the same time, I looked at my old books going back to 1845, and I studied what parcels. Why 1845? It's because that's the year Roederer bought the first parcel. So I have all the blends, so I know exactly in which blend each parcel went every year since 1845. So I did a study of what was doing very consistently Cristal, what was doing very consistently vintage, what was doing very consistently rosé and things like that. And what I found was unbelievable is that every plot which were making Cristal were the chalkiest block, where the subsoil was not deep, 1 meter, bedrock was 1 meter deep. And there was this kind of, you could see the roots going down and sitting on the bedrock and starting to dig slowly in the chalk. So there was a strong correlation, 99%, in between chalk content and Cristal blend. So I redefined all the estate. I said, these 45 plots, that Cristal plot, that chalky plot, that is vintage plot, that is Blanc de Blanc plot. This is, and now every domain is completely run to make one wine. And every viticulture is not the same. We do biodynamic in some, we don't do biodynamic in others. Plowing is not the same. Tilling is different. Leaf plucking is different. Pruning is different. So we have adapted to, we have different targets of number of buds according to the wine we want to make. For Cristal, we'll make a lower number of buds because we want to control the yields. For rosé, even less. And for vintage, we are much more generous because we want more focus on acidity and freshness. So all is really adapted to the wine. And finally, every year we do, picking decision is made in the fields. You know, we look at the grapes, we look at the berry, we look at the color, we test them, test the skin, test the seeds, test the pulp, test the freshness. All of that is all done by taste. And I, of course, I have analysis of everything to make sure that I'm in the right direction.
And so by the time the grapes come into the winery, a lot of your work for the style of the wine is kind of already done.
Yeah, it's 100% done, almost. I know exactly that I do parcel of vinification, so every single plot is in one tank. I have 410 blocks, 450 tanks. So everything is separated. I know that to the balance I've seen that this one is perfectly balanced. The fruit is fine, so it will go mostly in stainless steel. And it will be preserved as it is. My winemaking become preservation of balance. In some other places, I know that it was a little bit greener, a little bit not as balanced. So my winemaking would be a little bit more powerful. Soft would be oak fermentation, but I can be stronger by doing malolactic fermentation if need be. So everything is already set before harvest. I know exactly where I want to go. It doesn't mean that I'm right, but it means that I have an idea. For example, 15 years, in 2015, I prepared everything thinking that it would be a very warm, rich, fruity year. And after a week, I realized that it was not the case. Tasting the grapes, looking at the wine, tasting the wines, I realized that it was not like that at all. It was very fresh. It was maybe more classic. And that the terroir were very transparent this year. I was expecting the sun to take over the terroir. And in fact, the terroir was speaking loudly, you know. So then I changed my winemaking, you know. I didn't want to use too much oak. And now I'm convinced that the wine is really able to cope with oak. So I have changed my winemaking. So you have ideas, directions, but you can change your directions. So it's like doing judo, you know. You play with nature strength. I'm not imposing. I'm not saying you must do that. I'm just observing what is the strength and just playing with the strength to get what I think we should have. But really, really, really letting every terroir express itself and speak. That's the key.
Seems like those different wines, the intention is different. The Brut Premier, the Vintage, the Rosé, the Cristal Rosé. It seems like there's a different intention based on what you're picking to do and where you're picking it from and the kind of farming. Yeah.
There is the same intention, which is to let the terroir speak, because Cristal will be pure chalk. Cristal Rosé, of course, as well. Vintage will be chalk and clay. So the intention is a terroir. And then the winemaking is à la carte. I have tools, you know. I think it's like a library. You have many tools. When you start harvest, there must be all your drawer must be pushed, you know, and then you open your drawer when you need them, and not take all your power or your knowledge and things like that, because then you take over. You will have plenty of time to take control of the situation at blending time. Blending time, that's the time where you take control. You take simply control by using 1% of this, plus 2% of that, plus 3% of this, plus 5% of that. And that's a control. There you have control. But 9 months of the year, you are in single vineyard, terroir expression, not in a blending, not in a style construction. You are really in letting the terroir speak.
So it actually makes more sense to have each of those ingredients be distinctly different, because later you're going to blend and you don't want them to be all the same. Otherwise, that makes your job as a blender much more difficult.
Exactly. The more colors, the more pixels. Look at a picture, a photo. The more pixels you have, the more definition, the more high definition you get in the end. So look at every parcel as a pixel. And the more different they are, the better it is. It's almost like a cubist work, you know. Each plot is like a little element, a geometrical form, volume, a color that you have to know very well. It has to be consistent from testing to testing. And then it's up to you to build, to create a wall that is better than every form, you know. So that's where human being and knowledge is important.
So when you look at the landscape of the Champagne region, you have about 240 hectare vineyards to draw from. What do you see there? What are the commune differences? I mean, besides the fact that some are more chalky and some are more clay, what do you see that I can relate to a place name that draws differently as an ingredient than it would be if it were from a different place?
Yeah, that's the key. We talk a lot about climat in Burgundy, and we believe that Champagne has even more climat than Burgundy, because if you're south facing, if you're at the altitude, uphill or downhill or mid-slope, if you are facing south, facing east, facing north, if you are on chalk or on clay or on sand, if you are old vines or young vines, if you are Pinot Noir or Chardonnay, you get different expressions. And so we know roughly, we know that Ailly, for example, the terroir of Goutte-d'Or, of Bonnot in Ailly, and all those mid-slope terroirs that are known very well by all Champagne people, they bring this soft, round, very, very elegant, very unctuous style of wine if they are picked ripe. That's one of my important beliefs. You have to pick ripe. Never pick underripe fruit, or never overripe, but ripe. So Ailly will give you that. You know that Mareuil would be a little bit more green, which is not veggie, but it gives some more sappiness, some more length as well, but it's a little bit more rustic. Maybe this is why it's not a Grand Cru, it's a Premier Cru.
Even though they're nearby. I mean, they're adjoining.
Yeah, they're very close, but I think it's a question of soil again, source, springs, water, and things like that, exposure. You know that Verzenay will give you a very intense, powerful, yet round and elegant wine. I think maybe Verzenay is the most self-sufficient cru with Aviz, Côte des Blancs. They are the two most self-sufficient cru because they are all, everything can come together.
And you use that for the vintage?
Vintage, yeah, and Cristal also, on chalk, vintage on chalk and clay. You know that Verzy is a slight variation of Verzenay. It has not as much power. It is more floral, more acidified fruit, you know, more yuzu style of a fruit, which is very interesting to bring some lift, you know, in the aromatics. You know that Aviz is round and ripe and gives some roundness. I usually call it the Montrachet of Champagne. And you know that Ménil sur Roger would be longer. But that's generally speaking. After, if you are mid-slope, you don't have the same result if you are downhill or uphill. So that's where the classification Champagne, Grand Cru, Premier Cru is not very good because I much prefer the Burgundian classification. Because you can be Verzenay, but if you are downhill, that's not very elegant. It's ripe and not very elegant. If you are uphill, it's what we call the cold soils. It's very cool. It's very green. It's not very interesting. What is interesting is mid-slope, which is the top lieu-dit. That's why I never speak at Rodreur. I never speak in cru. I never say Verzenay, Verzy. I speak in lieu-dit. Only the lieu-dit is true to the terroir, so it can be Bonnot, Champromé, Pisse-Renard, Basse-Couture. They are the important things.
And what about the Côte de Blanc?
Côte de Blanc is chalk, definitely chalk. And the heart of Côte de Blanc, which is Cramant, Aviz, is really, really interesting. So it's planted in Chardonnay, of course. One important thing, we call it Côte de Blanc. But let's not forget that the real name, historic real name, is Côte Blanche. Not because there was white grapes on it, but because it was pure chalk. So this is I prefer to call it Côte Blanche because you can have some Pinot Noir on Côte Blanche. It's a choice, especially in Vertu. You will find some Pinot Noir. But most of it is Chardonnay. Then you come back to the grape variety, which is also different. We have two different animals. I won't speak about Meunier. We have some Meunier. I like Meunier. Meunier is important for Brut Premier, but I don't grow it. I just use it as a chef de cave. So I'm not very well positioned. I can give you an idea of the village, what I think is a village, but I don't grow it. So it will be not as precise as the growers.
Because the Brut Premier is the wine where you buy in some grapes.
Exactly. But what I know very well is Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. I grow them, and I see them as two different animals. Pinot Noir, for me, is what I call marathonian. It goes very slowly, very long ripeness, needs sun. If it's too wet, it struggles. And it tends to be oxidative. So you have to be careful with Pinot Noir, not to pick it overripe, because you could switch to oxidative taste. So it's a marathonian, but you have to be very careful on the ripeness. Chardonnay is exactly the opposite. It's reductive. It's a sprinter. It goes very fast, but it's good because you have to let it go. In Champagne, if you pick Chardonnay underripe, it's very floral and almost Sauvignon-y. Thiol, you know, very pamplemousse or pomelos, and I don't like it that way, you know. What I like is Chardonnay, which is rich, round, not honey-like, but which has some kind of chalky texture, a grain, we say, and you need to push ripeness. So I pick usually my Chardonnay very ripe, which is unusual in Côte des Blancs, unusual for most of the people, not unusual for Anselm Cellos. He picks ripe as well. So we are a few believers in ripe Chardonnay. And I think if you want Chardonnay to lose its varietal character, you need to push the ripeness. While Pinot Noir doesn't have a varietal character, Pinot Noir is transparency. It's, you don't need to fight against Pinot Noir. Pinot Noir is a king.
Does that riper Chardonnay imply a different response to sulfur?
Yeah.
If it were less ripe, would the sulfur stick out more?
Yeah, definitely. So I pick riper, but also I don't sulfur as a juice. I press it with a pneumatic press to be a bit more dynamic, because with Chardonnay, you need to push the extraction a little bit because the skin gets the aromatics. So if you not Pinot Noir, but in Chardonnay, so you need to push a little bit the extraction. And I do not sulfur Chardonnay at pressing. I will do it later after fermentation.
Because you want the information from the skins.
Exactly.
And if you sulfur it, you're going to lose that information on the skins.
Exactly, and the sulfur will take over. Then you will get a sulfur style, aromatic style that I don't want on Chardonnay. I don't want this.
So it's another example of how it's really a chain of decisions.
Yeah.
You start at the beginning of the chain so that you can make the decision you want at the end. Yeah.
And also the biodynamic farming has a strong effect, you know. I have learned that when you have a biodynamic fruit, it's more reductive than a non-biodynamic fruit. And you have to aerate it a little bit more. It's even more true, all what I'm saying about sulfur on Chardonnay, it's even more true on biodynamic fruit.
Now, why is that? Why is it more reductive for...
I don't know.
Okay.
It's facts. It's facts.
No, I hear it from many
people. Yeah. If I do ferment a biodynamic Chardonnay like a non-biodynamic Chardonnay, it's reductive. It's almost reduced. So I need to aerate it. I need to... Why? I believe... Why? I don't know. It's not a question of sulfur spray, because I use the same amount on my trials of organic and I don't have the same problem.
You use the same amount of sprays?
Yeah.
Because sometimes people say the biodynamic fruit's more reductive because they spray
it
more.
It is. Yeah, but I don't think it's sulfur. I believe, and I did a study with an enology this year, which shows that it's not the case again. So it's not a question of sulfur spray. It's maybe a question of root system, less mineralization, less, more packed. What I can see is the berries are smaller, so maybe more concentration of flavors. I call it reductive, but it's another kind of reduction, of reductive character, which is a reduction as a cook, you know, when you want to reduce
like a soup,
a sauce, a soup, you need to let it boil and evaporate. This is this kind of, you know, you concentrate so much the flavors that they are packed and you need to let them breathe a little bit more. So I have relearned winemaking after relearning viticulture. And that's very interesting. For my team of enologists, it's fascinating because we are opening some new windows.
Who do you talk to about that? I mean, when you see results like that, who do you talk to?
Geisenheim University in Germany, because why not Bordeaux or Champagne? Because Geisenheim is open to biodynamic farming. They have done a lot of trials, and this is a biodynamic country, so they're a little bit more open. But also, I can get some good vibes from Bordeaux University now. They accept to work on it. And so I need to go on this research level, PhD level, and things like that, to try to understand what's going on, knowing that maybe I will never get the answer. But what I see, what I test it.
Are you looking at the pruning as a response to vine diseases like Eutypa?
Yeah, not only that. I think we have forgot. The vines is an old lady. Pinot Noir has been domesticated by us in the Middle Age. So that's 1,000 years. 1,000 years that we are reproducing without any fecundation. Huh? Just replanting the same material, same genetic material, which is, in a way, the best way to become weak and not because you have climate change, you have different conditions. So on these old ladies, you need to have a really soft pruning, not a strong, hard pruning. You need to be very soft. And you need to keep as much sap as you can available for each bud, each spur position, each bud position. So you really need to keep the energy. I call it the energy, not the vigor. Let's not confuse with vigor, which is vigor is too much. But energy, I think the great terroir have energy. Energy in the growth. To make a great wine, you need a vine which is in good health. Because the better it is in health, the better it is able to face disease, downy mildew, powdery mildew, or ESCA, or UTPA, all those kinds of things. So, second idea, get more homogeneity in my bud positions to get a better, quite an even ripeness. Because sometimes you find, especially on the old vines, that one bunch is ripe and the other one is unripe. So you pick them twice, if you can. Or you mix them and then you have a ripe and an unripe, so it's a balance, it's not interesting. I would rather like to have something very even. And last but not least, I think it's, one more time, we come back to man. And I think with the old appellation system, we are taught the how of things, how you must prune. We are not taught anymore why we prune like that. So by doing the work we have done, it was a good way to come back to the why we prune that way, why we have this type of pruning, not how we do it, but why we do it. And when you look at the why instead of the how, you see different things.
But looking for more uniform ripeness also sounds like a man issue, because it sounds like a labor issue. It sounds like ripeness is a labor issue.
Yeah. Sometimes you get ripeness because nature gives it to you, but it's very rare. So to look for the ripeness, you need to work hard. It's a labor issue. Yeah, it's pruning. It's number of buds. It's yielding. It's all of that. You know, it's a balance. And I don't have the same target with Chardonnay and Pinot Noir. Chardonnay will be a little bit uploaded. You know, it can manage quite well with, let's say, 15 bunches, 14 bunches per vine. While Pinot Noir, if you go over 12 bunches, it doesn't work. It doesn't work. You never reach ripeness. So, yeah, it's labor, but vineyards is a labor story. You have to go in the vineyards. If you believe that you can have a vineyard without being in your vineyard every day, without doing every kind of work, and just controlling by computer, it's wrong. Or you will never have a drone or an automatic thing that will do. Yes, you will. We will invent that. But every time you go in your vineyard, you see new things. And this is what maybe is the truth about biodynamics sometimes. Maybe it is just being every day in your vineyards, seeing things that you were not seeing if you are just relying on chemicals.
And about the Pinot Noir, I feel like you farm it differently in different parcels, very much on purpose.
Yeah, yeah. It depends on the wine you want to make. I talked about Chardonnay saying it's a pulp grape. Easy to understand. If you squeeze a berry of Chardonnay when it's ripe, you squeeze it, what you will get out, it will open, and what will get out is a pulp. You will never have a drop of juice of Chardonnay. You have the pulp coming out. If you do the same with Pinot Noir, when it breaks, you immediately have the juice. So you have a juice, a skin. I call it a skin. Pinot Noir is a skin grape. Chardonnay is a pulp grape. The flavor is in the pulp in Chardonnay. The flavor is in the skin for Pinot Noir. So depending on the wine you want to make, if you make a rosé, you want a lot of skin ripeness. So you will do leaf plucking, you do leaf removal, you will do green harvesting, you will do all of that to get as much sun as you can on the skin for the skin to ripen and for the tannins to be as sweet as possible. If you make a vintage white, then you don't want any flavor from the skin in the wine. You want just the sap comes from the soil and don't get any aroma from the skin. So you don't want to any sun burn on your... So you keep leaves on the benches to get more minerality. you look for more minerality, more floral, but no fruit character. So that's two different viticultures. You make a rosé, it's a red wine-making viticulture. So you skin, sun, low yielding. If you make vintage white, no sun. That's why the pruning brings, in Champagne, the pruning, especially in Chardonnay, the Chablis pruning is designed to bring the bunches into the canopy. While in Burgundy, the Roya is made for the bunches to be at the sun. So we are completely different. So our ancient tradition knew that we have to go away from the sun when you make a white champagne, because you don't want the sun. You want freshness. You want precision. If you make a rosé, you go for the sun. So you really have to adapt your vineyard work. It's one part of it. The pruning is adapted. The debudding is adapted. Many steps.
So in 2006, you did the Brut Nature, and I feel like it was almost a challenge for yourself conceptually to see if you could pull it off, because some of it is different than how you normally make the wines in terms of you're not blending, you're doing a co-ferment. And so you almost had to take some of the philosophies you've already talked about and take them one step further and blend the wine from grapes. So how did that happen, and what was the impetus for that, and what did you find out?
It's first, we were working on biodynamic, we're working on all this, trying to find some new way, innovating in the vineyards, innovating in the fruit, innovating, thinking. And at the same time, we had this long talks with Philippe Starck, you know, the French designer. And he loves champagne. And then he came to a talk on modern wine. What would be a modern wine? And what did we say? We say a modern wine has to be more immediate, more sensual, more minimalist, maybe less sophisticated. So that was the idea we had. And then we looked at our practices and we say, okay, let's change our mind and let's come back to the essential of things. What is knowledge? And what would be the new thing? First, before Philippe came, we were already working on climate change. That's what was a plan we launched back in 2000. Plan was to understand what would be the climate change effect. What would be a global warming effect on grapes? What would be the next step? So all of that brought together, we decided to be true to one slope, one area, instead of going and picking. Leaving maybe less human interventions, even the blending. We forgot blending. We knew that it was not a Rodroir wine we were making. It was to create something different. So we forgot everything we knew. And we really simplified everything. Simplified. Biodynamic, picking Pinot Noir, Chardonnay, Meunier, same day, fruit day. Co-pressing, co-fermenting, little racking, half oak, half stainless steel, picked very ripe. Only in a warm year, so not in a cool year, because that's the climate change idea. Warm, drier, see what it does. And then let it do the bottling at low pressure to really let the bubble behind the wine. And in the end, no dosage and things like that. So I think this is the idea we got is let's do it another way. That's not at all what we have been told to do or what we have learned, but let's maybe put together all our ideas today and see what the wine would be. What is very interesting in that concept is that we didn't have, usually when you make a wine as a winemaker, you have a target. I want to make this type of wine. It has to be fresh like that, smell this and smell that, and you direct all your practices to reach that. What we've done is the exact opposite. We say we don't want to know what will be the end product. We have no specific target. But what we know is that we have to do minimal, less is more everywhere. So we did the most elegant gesture at all step. And the end result was Brut Nature. So I don't see it as a Rodroir wine. It is, but I don't see it as a Rodroir wine. I see it as our lab. Or let's call it bande annonce, you know, like a pitch for the future. It's a pitch. That's a wine that is a pitch. I would have never done it without Philippe Starck, and it opens completely new windows. So it's really a pitch of what could be, maybe champagne, in 40 years or in 50 years if global warming goes up. And it's not even a brute nature. It's not even because the zero dosage doesn't mean anything for me. You know, I didn't intend to make a zero dosage. In the end, it didn't need dosage. And everybody who tests it is always surprised. You know, everybody says expect a brute nature with very high acidity, very lean. And most of the people are very surprised by the wine roundness, the depth. And often they say, but it's not true. It's not zero dosage. It's because I feel some sweetness in it. I feel some roundness. So it's quite surprising. It's a brut nature that is not a zero dosage. It is a zero dosage, but it doesn't taste like it.
So did you find that some of that experience is going to play back into some of the other wines that you make?
Yeah. Yes. The biodynamic, the pressure ID.
Using lower pressure.
Yeah. Okay. I have decreased the pressure.
Which makes it seem more vinous.
More vinous and more unctuous. I prefer the unctuous, you know, the creamier texture. We have also reduced the dosage on all the range. You know, I'm preparing the Crystal 09 for in a year time. And the dosage will be the lowest ever. On Crystal, you know, it will be 8.5 grams, I think, which is the lowest ever. Non-malolactic, eh? I mean, be careful, because dosage people always talk about the level of sugar, but it doesn't mean anything.
Because you don't put the wine through mallow.
Exactly.
So the acidity is different.
Yeah,
then.
Yeah. So 9 grams, I always say 9 grams without malolactic. If you want to know the figure of dosage with malolactic, you divide by half. So 9 grams without malolactic is like 4.5 grams with malolactic.
What should I understand about Cristal? I mean, I feel like it's one of those wines where the brand recognition or the branding has almost overshadowed the wine. And that must be nice sometimes, and it must be frustrating other times. I don't know. Mm. But if I were to talk about the wine, Cristal and Cristal Rosé, what should I know about those wines?
You should know that to make one bottle of Cristal, it takes about 55 years. 55 years, because I use the average age of the vineyard is 40, 45 years, plus 7 years on lease, plus... So it takes... A single bottle of Cristal is 55 years of work. So it's a lot of work, a lot of time. Time is very important for Cristal. I always say it's almost time in the bottle, Cristal. What you should know is all those white soils, because it's chalk, pure chalk, Pinot Noir and Chardonnay on chalk. Maybe the Pinot Noir on chalk is the secret of Cristal, because usually Champenois put Chardonnay on chalk because it makes more sense for the style of Chardonnay. But Rodreur, we put Pinot Noir on chalk, which makes a Pinot Noir with a taste of Chardonnay, which is a very amazing, or a taste of chalk, because that's maybe in the end that's the chalk you taste. And what you should know, we don't do malolactic fermentation. We keep it we pick very ripe. We don't chaptalize because it's very ripe. We do partial oak fermentation, yes. What you should know also is about 50% of the estate, 45 plots, is horse tilled. 50% is tractor tilled. It's not for the marketing or for the photo. It's just because when it's old, in the case of Cristal, after 50, 55 year old, you have such heterogeneity in the vineyards and in the pruning that a tractor, if you go tilling with a tractor, you will really scrap some of the vines. So you need to be haute precision, very precise tilling, and you can only do it by horse. So all the old vines are horse tilled, and the 30, 25, 30, 40-year-old vines are tractor tilled. What you should know is that it's 45, 50 plots of an average of 2 hectares each plot. So it's like 50 Romane Conti size plots. And very important, the selection at testing when we do the blending is one, which is it has to be chalky. So Chardonnay or Pinot Noir, it has to be chalky. If it's a beautiful fruity Pinot Noir style, it doesn't go into Cristal. If it's a beautiful Chardonnay varietal, it doesn't go into Cristal. It only goes into crystal when it's pure chalk filling.
When you can taste that.
When you can taste it. And then it goes into the blend. And then we look at the ratio of Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. So there is no formula. Sometimes it can be 60% Chardonnay, 40% Pinot Noir in the end. Sometimes it can be 75% Pinot Noir and 25% Chardonnay. So from one crystal to another, you can have a real jump in grape variety, big difference, but it's always coming from the same plots. Not always, we don't take all the same plots, but and we select just to this idea of bringing into the crystal bottle a pure, precise, very elegant chalk taste.
When you grow Pinot Noir on chalk, what happens?
It's very hard because Pinot Noir likes a little bit of clay because it's richer. And so it grows quicker on clay and you have a higher yield. This is why on Côte des Blancs, you have Chardonnay, because if you go back at the 1800 in Côte Blanche, 1800, we didn't know Chardonnay because it was only domesticated in 1880, Chardonnay. So mostly it was Pinot Noir. But the Côte Blanche was not planted with Pinot Noir because it was on pure chalk. Pinot Noir was really struggling. And so it takes a long time to grow Pinot Noir on chalk, and it needs low yields. You need to crop 30% lower yields on chalk than you can do it on chalk and clay to get ripeness. So it's difficult. So a vigneron will not do it because it takes time, he doesn't have the yields he wants, and things like that. But when you are a winemaker and you look for this extreme elegance, you can do it for crystal. So I didn't come and say this is Pinot Noir and things like that. No, it was already done. But I think what I found is that the common denominator, a start of explanation, not this is good, it goes into crystal, but just a start of explanation. And this is very modest. Huh? It's my predecessor and their predecessor knew that those blocks were doing very well and were crystal designed, you know.
Jean-Baptiste Lecquillon realized in an early age that nature is bigger than all of us, but he's, through time, done his best to shorten the distance. Thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you very much, Lévy.
Jean-Baptiste Lecquillon of Champagne, Louis Roeder. Yes, indeed, we have started a wine club with Crush Wine and Spirits in Manhattan. This means that if you would like to take advantage of regularly discounted offers on wines that we feature on the show, the process is now even easier. If you email me directly at levyopenswine@gmail.com, as several of you have already done, we can get you set up with Crush so that the selections are set aside for you as they come out and shipped when you'd like. This is a great way to save on shipping costs by grouping together bottles, and it makes buying wines from the show much more streamlined so that you can skip having to individually order each wine. Just send me an email to levyopenswine@gmail.com and we'll take care of the details. Pretty soon you'll be drinking the wines you're hearing the producers speak about on this show, and honestly, that is one of the easiest and most in-depth ways to get a grasp on the wine world today. We want to thank you for listening to the show. We were able to bring you almost 100 long-form, in-depth, and well-researched episodes in 2015, and we featured interviews with the likes of Aubert Duvalet, Terry Thies, Oz Clark, Yasko Grovner, Michelle Lafarge, Justo Acapinti, Jeffrey Grosset, Carol Meredith, and Maria Jose Lopez de Heredia, as well as many, many other great, great persons who are doing excellent work in wine. We have accomplished all of this with no studio, no corporate ownership, and no staff. There is Levy, that's me, working in a studio apartment from his couch, and there's Aaron, and that's it. That's the whole ballgame. If you would like to help continue the success of this podcast and to help it grow the right way and well in 2016, please consider making a donation in support of the show. This program doesn't happen in a vacuum, and your action can really make a difference. Go to alldrinktothatpod.com, that's alldrinktothatpod.com, to find out further information and make a donation. If you listen to the show regularly, you know what it's worth to you already. We hope that you'll show your support.